Salam, dear listeners. This is Prem from Team Radio Sai coming to you live from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam. It is with much regret that I have to inform you that we are not going to be doing our Thursday afternoon satsang live today. Due to some unforeseen circumstances, we are forced to postpone the special Aradhana Day reflections we thought we will present to you today. We are very sorry about that, dear listeners. We hope that we will be able to carry forward this theme for the next week. For now, we will be replaying an old satsang, and we hope that this too will add to the moment of the Aradhana Mahotsav, the festival that we are going to be celebrating tomorrow. We will be playing a satsang that Arvind and myself had a couple of years ago. This is about, is it wrong to miss Swami? And this is a satsang which we feel will definitely add to the Aradhana Mahotsav mood. Just a piece of information to all of you, don't miss the morning session of the Aradhana Mahotsav tomorrow, because the five Pancharatna Kritis, which are specially composed for this occasion, will be presented for the first time. Of course, the first two have been presented the last year. The five Pancharatna Kritis, with the three remaining ones, will be presented for the first time to Bhagwan tomorrow morning as part of the Mandir session, which will also be webcast live on our website, radiosai.org. For now, dear listeners, for your listening pleasure, a satsang, Is It Wrong to Miss Swami, which Arvind and myself hosted a couple of years back. Once again, we regret that we are not able to do a live satsang this week. We hope and pray that we will be able to bring the topic again for you next week. Till I meet you next week with Arvind, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai.
Om Shri Sai Ram, dear listeners, this is Arvind from Team Radio Sai, who is joined as always with Prem from Team Radio Sai for the afternoon satsang.
Sai Ram Arvind, and a very warm Sai Ram to all our listeners.
The special thing about the New Year celebrations was that the alumni of primary school, the higher secondary school, the university, all had been to Parthi, and it was such a beautiful time to meet up with all and relive some of those most beautiful days. Really, Prem, listening to them speak about their experiences, you know, I heard some stories from the 1980s, some from the 1970s, some from the 2000s. All these, they brought out different facets of the way Swami interacted with the students, the way Swami interacted with the devotees. Listening to all that, it was such a joy, and hearing all this, you begin to miss those so much. You just wish that, oh, how I wish I could see this. How I wish I could have also been there when this happened. How I wish that such things can happen again. Oh my God, the way I missed Swami, especially on the 31st of December and on the 1st of January. The 31st of December, we had a program by the primary school alumni. On the 1st of January, we had a program by the university alumni. Program was one thing. Meeting up with them behind the scenes, after the program, before the program, catching up and hearing about the stories of how Swami has impacted their lives. Oh my God, you just can't help but miss Swami, that beautiful form, that robed form, that little form which has captured the whole universe in such a big manner.
And also sometimes, you know, when you look at some of your classmates, Invariably we associate some moments with Swami, with each classmate.
Correct.
You know, it's otherwise, you know, if you had studied in any other college, maybe pranks will come to our mind, and maybe our relationship with that person will come to our mind. But invariably, when you meet alumni, when you meet your former classmates, you always tend to think of those moments when they would have had an interaction with Swami and you were a witness to that interaction.
Exactly. Swami becomes the common denominator. He becomes the highest common factor. He becomes the least common multiple. You know, in mathematical terms, if we have to say it, he is the thread that bonds us all together. And, you know, it is indeed a pleasure. And sometimes, you know, it's a kind of pain also, Prem, because as the new year began, I began to miss Swami so much. It was as if without any effort or without any attempt, tears were spontaneously coming out of the eyes. And I was hoping that how beautiful it'll be if I can see Swami. How beautiful Swami, just once if I can see the form, it'll be a great thing.
And all said and done, I think everybody, each one of us, do miss Swami, that physical form, which has come to occupy such an important place in our lives.
It's become the first priority in our lives.
Exactly. That is because it has occupied a space which nothing else can fill. The truth is that because when Swami was there physically, we tried to put as much of our thoughts and actions, have them centered around that physical form, that now we are coming to a point where we are struggling to fill that.
It feels like a void, and nothing seems to have the capacity to fill the void. Especially on the New Year's Day, that evening, I was sitting and thinking about the beautiful days with Swami, the darshan, where he would come gently gliding. Even when he came on the wheelchair, never for a moment did he look like a patient or did he look like somebody who is not fully fine. In any form, Swami was so beautiful, whether he came walking, whether he came in the wheelchair, whether he came in the car. And seeing him gave such thrills of joy that now, when we are not apparently not able to do it, it feels so, so empty and we miss him so much.
And invariably, you know, when we miss Swami and moments when we really look forward, I mean, you just have, as I said, there's nothing which can fill that place. But I think at that moment we start to rationalize within ourselves. You know, Swami is after all always there. Swami has never left us. Why should we feel sad? I think what we're doing is, the pain is very, very spontaneous actually. We are not kindling that pain. That pain is very spontaneous, but we're trying to rationally and intellectually break down that pain.
I somehow find it contradictory. When Swami was with us physically, we used to always say, this is our great good fortune. This is an opportunity that you have got or we have got. We don't know for what merits in the previous births. This is not something that everybody gets. It is indeed a great blessing that we have got a chance to visit Prashanti. We say all this, and obviously all this is because of the physical form of the Lord. And when the Lord's physical form is not there, we say that it doesn't make a difference. It's the same. The Lord is everywhere. How can it be possible? If the Lord was everywhere before and after, why is it that we flock to Puttaparthi? Whatever may be said, whatever may be the wisdom that is showered liberally upon us from all quarters, my heart just refuses to let go of its firm conviction that there is something magical, something beautiful about the form that the formless cannot replace.
Most definitely. I remember once, you know, in Trai, Swami asked one boy to speak, one of my seniors. And he spoke very nicely, and he spoke about the days when he goes back home during vacation, and a couple of times when Swami showed him that Swami was always with him. And he was narrating a few incidents like that. And Swami was very happy with his talk. In the end of the talk, Swami was just conversing with him. And in the conversation, he mentioned, Swami, please come to Puttaparthi. Because this was happening during the vacations in Vrindavan, Trai sessions.
Okay.
And he was praying to Swami to come back to Puttaparthi.
Because he is a student.
Yeah, he was a student in Prashanthi Nilayam. So that, you know, he can have Swami's presence in the Prashanthi Nilayam campus. This altercation was going on for a while, and suddenly Swami said, Indra, till now you were talking about the omnipresence of Swami, and now you're asking for Swami's presence. Till now you said Swami is everywhere, and now you're telling Swami, please come to Puttaparthi because it's so nice if you're there. Okay, and that moment, nobody could say anything. Okay, it was like we were just as students hoping that somebody would talk on our behalf and, you know, put Swami
in place
and tell him that, you know, we agree with all that you say, but not this one. And that boy had a very, very beautiful statement to say, to which Swami didn't have a reply.
Oh, what was that?
Yeah, and so he just made one sentence. He said, Swami, your presence is sweeter than your omnipresence. And Swami just smiled.
You know, Prem, on so many occasions, when I say this, I'm just quoting my example as a thing because that is what I have experienced. But this is happening everywhere, you know. We see Vibhuti coming out of photographs. We see Kumkum coming out of photographs. And recently too, at home, you know, we were sitting and we were talking, especially after all this happened, so much of Swami memory came. We were talking about the beautiful times with Swami. We were all shedding tears, you know, as a family, we were recollecting those beautiful days. And there was Vibhuti that appeared on Swami's photograph. Usually, you know, when Vibhuti comes, it's such a grand thing, such a glorious thing, such a happy thing, we go and celebrate it. But this time, when it happened, the thought that came in us was, no, Swami, you cannot. I mean, no, this is not a compensation. This is not a substitute. You may fill the room with Vibhuti. You may make the sky come down and turn into gold. It's a fantastic miracle, Swami. But But still, Swami, I would trade that for one moment of being able to see you, look into your eyes, hold your hand, touch your feet, because that joy is something so beautiful. I cross my heart as I say that I would be ready to trade any of these miracles that are happening in my life for one glimpse of Swami. And I feel, what is wrong in pining for it? Because whenever I've got a chance to express this, or whenever I see others expressing it, the response that comes is, it's time for you to move on. It's time for you to grow. I don't want to grow out of it. I want to live in that pining and longing and wanting for that physical form, because there is so much joy and beauty in that. I may be shedding tears, but I feel pining and missing His presence brings one kind of joy and a fulfillment within, so deep that it can't be expressed. It is so wonderful in itself. What do you think, Prem? Is it wrong to miss Him and pine for the physical presence?
A couple of things. You know, one thing what I always feel is, we imagine growth. We imagine that, oh, I have to be like that. It is one good thing to set targets and work towards it. But, you know, Swami would often say, I remember talking to one of my lecturers, and he would say that when he was a student in Vrindavan in the 70s, Swami would always make the students focus on the physical form. You know, Swami would do actions and activities in such a way and arrange schedules in the hostel in such a way that they will all be focused on this physical form.
Correct.
Okay, and Swami used to tell, take Padnamaskar, you will not get this again. Swami used to often keep repeating it. He said that one moment came, one day, Swami had called him for an interview. Okay, and he had actually grown in this since childhood. So for him, Swami was everything. Swami in that physical form was everything. And he said one day, Swami called him inside the interview room, he alone. And Swami entered, latched the door, and just turned back and said, how long are you going to run behind this body? And he said it was a shock for him, because it was Swami who had encouraged them to go after the body. And here was a Swami who was suddenly saying, how long are you going to run after this body? What he said after this, you know, the understanding which he shared with me, he said, let Swami choose when you have to move on.
Correct.
You know, let Swami guide you. Why do you have to force that feeling that, no, I have to move on now. No, I have to grow up now. He said, if that pain is spontaneous, if that yearning is spontaneous, that will actually define your path.
Yes, that may be the path.
Yes. And, you know, coming to look of it, whenever you hear a Tyagaraja Kirtana or a Meera Bhajan or any song written by a devotee, Surdas, we can actually relate to that pain of the devotee. And we are able to relate to that pain because this physical form is there in our life.
Correct.
Imagine, we wouldn't have pined and we wouldn't have had this devotion for Swami if not for Swami physically being in our life.
Correct, Prem. Just imagine today, if we have a look at how many thousands of devotees across the globe are, you know, pining and longing for Swami, and they're doing some incredible things. Going to the remote forests, serving people there, setting up projects, doing things they would have never done. And why they're doing it? Because if I do this, my Swami will be happy. This was happening even when Swami was physically there. And they do it knowing in their heart that my Swami knows. How many have received physical acknowledgement that I know that you are doing this? Very few, a blessed few. There are so many blessed many who have not received this acknowledgement, and yet they have worked on in faith and conviction. But that faith and conviction came because of the form.
Very true. I think we might have had this discussion earlier, saying that in what way has dharma been established by the coming of the avatar?
Correct.
And you know, we spoke of how after every avatar, after the Rama avatar, after Krishna avatar, there was a decline in the overall dharma of the age. From Satyayuga, you came to the Treta Yuga, Treta Yuga to Dwapara, and Dwapara to the worst Kali.
And now also, after Swami is leaving, it doesn't look like the world has become a...
Very true. Once in a discourse, Swami actually explained what is the dharma samsthapana which happens every time an avatar comes. And Swami said, the only dharma which is worth establishing and which the avatar establishes is that of prema dharma. He said he installs that love in each one's heart. And even if you look at the declaration God makes in Gita in the same shloka, he says, paritranaya sadhunam vinashaya chatushrutam. Okay, and if you look at it, to destroy evil is like an afterthought.
Correct.
He said, I have come to establish goodness and also destroy bad.
Correct.
But we actually concentrate on God has come to destroy bad, and when we look around and see that nothing has improved, we say, what has God done? But the fact is, Swami has woken up a Tyagaraja in each one of us. Swami has actually inspired a Meera in each one of us. We can think like how Mira thought. We can think like how Suldas or Tukaram thought. And I think that is the thing which that physical form is inspired. And in fact, we are actually feeling the same feelings which Tukaram or Tyagaraja felt. And by saying that to yearn is wrong, is like belittling these great devotees, isn't it?
And another aspect, Prem, if you notice, see, it is wrong to equate this longing for Swami as the physical attachment that we consider in the worldly sense. Of course, it is attachment to the form. But let's say we are attached to our parents, we are attached to our friends, we are attached to so many things. Suppose we lose a friend. Suppose a person vanishes from the face of the earth. Now, different people have different degrees of attachment to him, to that person. So, the close friend feel intensely and for years after that. Some people feel for that day and some people are not touched at all. But you see, when it comes to Swami, it is a unique kind of attachment. This kind of intensity of longing and missing is common across everybody. A person who has had 100 interviews misses Swami. And if you think that he is missing Swami because he has had 100 interviews, he has interacted with Swami on a day-to-day basis,
he's got more attached to the form.
You are mistaken, because another person who has just watched Swami once has got so attached to the form. And why this, Prem? I'm telling you, recently I received an email from one lady and she says she came to know Swami, know about Swami, hear about Swami on the 24th of April 2011. And that too, it was because a colleague of hers who was a student in the college here had changed his status message to one of mourning. And that is how she came to know about the passing of Satya Sai Baba. And today, she is madly in love with Swami. She has not seen Swami. She longs to see Swami. She feels that how she missed out on seeing Swami. How is this possible? How is it possible that if you consider it as attachment, I mean, we have lost our grandfathers, some of us have lost our parents, we have lost. If I have not seen my grandfather, I have not seen my grandfather. So I have no attachment for him. I just know his photograph, this is my grandfather.
Because we would keep sitting and mourning all our forefathers.
How is it possible that a person who is no longer in the physical, after leaving the physical, is able to make somebody so attached? This is something very special in this attachment. It is not like any other ordinary attachment, and therefore I feel the logic or the wisdom that is put and said that it is time to move on, go beyond the physical, doesn't hold good when it comes to Swami, because it is not like any other attachment on the face of the earth.
And I'm just reminded of one thing very interesting one of my friends shared with me. You were comparing other attachments to that of Swami. And he said, see, every relationship is one of possessiveness. You know, you feel this is my brother, this is my mother, my father, and you are losing somebody who's yours. But losing Swami was losing somebody to whom you belonged.
Beautiful.
And the difference is that.
Correct.
So that is why it cannot be compared with any other loss, because this is not losing somebody, but this is losing yourself actually.
And one more thing, Prem, is suppose I'm missing my friend whom I lost or somebody whom I lost. That's it. You feel like overcoming it because you feel it's no use mourning that. But when it comes to Swami, who can put a limit on the capabilities of Swami? If I pine strong enough, Swami will appear. I will see him in flesh and blood right in front of my eyes. It is possible. And Swami has said that. He has said that you should hold on with determination and seek till you get what you are seeking, or till you collapse from the effort. Either one of the two things should happen. But if you do that, if you need me, you deserve me. And Swami has promised that where there is longing, he will manifest. And it's not only as this avatar. As Vishnu told Narada, he said, Mad bhakta yatra gayanti tatra tishtami. Wherever my glory is sung, I shall install myself there. All these are not empty promises. And that is one more reason I feel that we should pine and seek. Because when we pine and seek, we will find. Even Jesus said, seek and it shall be given. Knock on the door and it shall be opened.
I'm reminded of, you know, two interesting stories. One in a discourse which Swami narrates. And Swami says somebody builds a Shirdi Baba temple and the devotee goes to the temple. The priest of the temple tells him that you have to come here for 41 Thursdays, 11 okay. Thursdays or something. And at the end of it, you will get the grace of Baba.
Okay.
And Swami narrating this, he says, why should it take 41 Thursdays? Why should it take 11 Thursdays? It takes only one moment of true yearning. Swami goes on to say, these are all just tactics to make crowd come again and again to the temple.
Okay.
And you know, another story I remember is, there's a famous Hanuman temple, where it is believed if you go 31 days to that temple and do some 108 pradakshinas for 31 days and a certain ritual, you follow it, on the 31st day, Hanuman would manifest in front of you and give darshan. So one devotee goes and he very, very sincerely does this. And on the 31st day, actually Hanuman comes and gives him darshan. And then Hanuman tells him that actually I would have come to you on the first day. But you were so obsessed with the thought
of 31
that only
days.
After 31 days you'll get the darshan. I had to wait 31 days.
And so too, such obsessions can be dangerous, because if Hanuman had come on the first day, this person would not have identified at all. And because it can't be, it has to be on the 31st day. So coming back, this kind of longing is justified because Swami has all the capacity to manifest. And it is happening. It is happening before so many people around the globe. How many stories have we not heard, Prem? When I hear it, I feel one day it will happen to me too. And why not? That used to be the same longing when we used to sit and see Swami giving interviews. We never receive an interview, but yet we come and sit and long because we hope and pray that someday I too will receive the same interview. Why don't we do the same now? When we hear a story of Swami manifesting in front of somebody, instead of going and trying to worship that somebody or trying to get lost in those secondary bylanes, why don't we hold on to Swami and say that, Swami, if you could show yourself to him, you can show yourself to me also, and I shall wait, I shall wait, I shall wait. And that gives us hope, and that gives meaning to the pining.
Very true, Arvind. As you said, you know, so how many we have not heard of Swami coming? One thing which I heard sometime back was to a person in whose meditation Swami appeared, and you know, Swami was guiding him. He said for years together he had this contact with Swami, but he didn't realize that this person was actually a living being. He thought he was a great master who was contacting him from some higher realm.
Okay.
But he said it didn't make a difference to him. And I feel it didn't make a difference to him because I think it all lies in our perception. And we kind of, with our limited perception, try to limit the Lord we are seeing. Right? And Arvind, there's so much to talk about this. And I think what we've established here is, if that pain is spontaneous, if that pining and yearning is spontaneous, I don't think we need to be guilty of it. We don't have to rationalize it, logically
try to say that what we are doing is wrong, we are not supposed to be feeling it. If it is spontaneous, anything spontaneous is divine. And as long as we spontaneously feel that outburst, let us feel happy that we are in some way connected to our Lord and allow this spontaneity to flow forth. And before we proceed further, Prem, maybe we should play that song from the drama where a doctor, he spontaneously feels this pining for Swami and cries out, when shall I see you, Lord? When shall I see you, Lord? And in that drama, at the end of this song, Swami appears and he sees Swami. Well, what happens in drama can happen in real life too, because life too is a drama after all, isn't it?
Very true. It's a beautiful song which actually captures the feeling I think most of us would have felt sometime or the other in these past couple of years.
लगी है तेरे दर्शन की प्यास
Yes, Arvind, that indeed was a very beautiful song, and I still remember the effect that had on that day in Purnachandra when the song was played. The story goes that in the drama, at the end of the song, he actually has the vision of Swami.
Correct.
Though he doesn't know Swami, and the story goes on like that. Coming back to this discussion, Arvind, the idea that yearning and pain can also be a means to attain the ultimate understanding, ultimate realization, and not that it is only through intellectual reasoning and rationaling that you can reach that state.
Very true, Prem. If we see the history, Adi Shankaracharya, he is considered as the exponent of Advaita. Advaita, which states that there is only one and there is no second. So everybody is divine. This is the ultimate knowledge. Everybody is divine, and therefore nobody needs to worship anybody else. In what could be considered as a great paradox, he had one disciple by the name Padmapada who worshipped him, who adored him, who loved him so much. If you see intellectually, this seems so wrong. Because if Swami says, if you love me, follow me. And if you love Shankaracharya, you have to follow Shankaracharya. And Shankaracharya's teachings is nobody needs to be worshipped, because everybody is divine. But here is his disciple who is adoring him. And yet, there is something very special about Padmapada. You know, Padmapada was one among the foremost disciples of Adi Shankara. And his other disciples, they always looked down upon Padmapada. They mocked him. At times even demeaned him, because they felt that he was not up to the mark. He doesn't seem to be progressing intellectually at all. He's all the while lost in
serving
Shankara. So where is the progress that he's making? So they felt that he was a laggard in the class. No progress at all. But then, you know, one day Adi Shankara silenced all of them through a single act. The story goes that Padmapada was on the other side of a river bank. He was busy in something when Adi Shankara calls out for him. So implicit is his obedience, love and faith also in Shankara, that he just turns and runs. And the story goes that wherever he put a foot on the river, a lotus blossomed and held him afloat on the water. He walked on the water, and that is how his name became Padmapada. I am not aware of what was the original name, but all of us know him today as Padmapada. Padma meaning lotus and pada is feet. Because wherever he put his foot, a lotus blossomed and held him on the surface of the water. And this was something that none of the other disciples of Shankaracharya...
The story goes that at the end of this episode, actually Shankara confers upon him all the knowledge which the others were striving to achieve.
Look at that. All their life they have been putting effort to achieve something simply by serving the master and just longing, pining and loving the physical form of the master. Padmapada achieves it simply through that.
Very similar story happens in the life of Gautama Buddha too. The story of Ananda.
One of the foremost disciples of...
Yeah, and it is told many times. But whenever it was told, I used to feel that we are being a little unfair to the love that Ananda had for Buddha. Because he actually happens to be a cousin of Buddha.
Correct.
Who, when he becomes a disciple, he takes a vow from Buddha that I will be the closest to you physically. So he said, you will never speak to a third person in my absence, and you will never sleep in a room where I am not sleeping to serve you, and you will always give me the opportunity to be the closest disciple. So Buddha agrees with it and he becomes a disciple of Buddha. And it so happens that he loses many years in only serving Buddha physically. And as just like Padmapada, he's not a person who has been receptive to the message of Buddha, but he's actually served Buddha. But what is important is he has loved Buddha all his life. He has made this physical manifestation of his divinity as the very basis of his life. Okay, and it so happens that when Buddha is lying on his deathbed, all the other disciples of Buddha are in a state of mental equipoise where they can accept what Buddha is giving them in the form of departing physically. But only person who couldn't take it at all was Ananda, because he was so attached to the body. Okay, and we often hear the story being told like everybody was at peace and Ananda was crying.
Correct.
And the story goes that all these disciples decide to have a conclave. They all want to come together and they want to document all the messages, all the teachings of the Buddha, and on the basis of what they've understood, what their experience has taught them. So there is this conclave. They enter a room where all these disciples, but Ananda alone, who is still not able to come to terms with this grief which has struck him, is sitting outside in the room where these people are talking. And he cries the whole night. And the whole night the conclave is going on inside, and he's sitting outside and crying. And in that pain and in that yearning, in a moment, actually that realization steps in. What Buddha really is, and that Buddha cannot leave him.
He gets enlightened.
He gets enlightened. And the moment he gets enlightened, the room where the conclave is happening, the doors open. And the disciples of Buddha say, you can come in, you can join, you're one of us now.
This story is often presented as, see the plight of Ananda. When everyone else had progressed, Ananda had not progressed at all. What we don't realize is, if we look at it in another perspective, Ananda had the cake and ate it also. Because when the Buddha was there, he did not do those years of rigorous efforts that the others did in order to achieve. He was just lost in serving the Buddha. And after the Buddha left, in just one night of crying and pining, he achieved all that the others had achieved through years of hard work and penance.
And that really shows what true yearning and pining can do. I'm reminded of the life of Ramakrishna Paramahamsa too. You know, he is known as a devotee who always cried for mother and pined for her. And finally, eventually he gets that communion where he is able to go and talk to Mother Kali. At that time, who is known to be as Ramakrishna Paramahamsa's guru, Totapuri, he is a great Advaitin. He is a person who is absolutely fixed in that thought of Advaita, that he has reached that state where he himself sees himself as God. Now he comes by and he takes it upon himself to educate Ramakrishna Paramahamsa in the path of
Advaita.
So the story goes that he makes Ramakrishna sit and say that you're losing yourself. You're a devotee, but you're losing yourself in this maya that this mother is real. You know, he goes on to tell that the whole world is unreal. You're unreal. Even your mother is unreal. Okay, and Ramakrishna is not able to take it. He starts crying like a child. He runs to the presence of Mother Kali and he says, this Totapuri is saying like this, Mother, is it true that you are also unreal? And Mother Goddess says that, yes, Ramakrishna, I am also unreal. So he is very, very hurt, and the mother tells him that, don't worry, you will progress. So he goes back and the story goes that for so many days, 3 days I think, Totapuri makes Ramakrishna sit and tries to tell him that you have to go beyond the mother form. And he says that every time he goes, the mother's form comes as a veil, and he's not able to progress beyond that. You know, he reaches great meditative states, but when that mother's form comes, he's not able to go beyond that. And in frustration, it seems, Totapuri picks up a piece of glass and pierces it in that spot between the eyebrows of Ramakrishna. And he says, where it's paining now, concentrate there. Okay, and he starts concentrating, and he says, take the sword of discrimination and tear the veil that the mother's form is. Okay, and Ramakrishna does that, you know, he imagines that he does that, and then he goes into that state of Advaita, of bliss. Okay, and reaches that state and he's not able to come out of it. He's in that bliss. And that time Totapuri thinks, my God, what took me 30 years? This man has achieved in 3 days. And Totapuri himself is shocked, and it seems it comes around that Totapuri realizes that this form cannot be false like the rest of the world.
Correct.
This form running after which he has reached the ultimate state, it cannot be completely false. So he becomes a devotee of Mother.
So you see, a person who firmly entrenched on the path of Bhakti Yoga is given Jnana, and another on the path of Jnana Yoga is given Bhakti.
Very true. And in fact, Vivekananda himself used to say that, you know, when he's talking about Ramakrishna, he used to say he is a Jnani wearing the cloak of a Bhakta. And I am actually a Bhakta because inside I have a lot of fear and insecurity wearing the cloak of a Jnani.
Wow. So I think, Prem, both of us are definitely convinced that there is nothing wrong. It's a misconception to think that pining for the Lord is a weakness, it's a flaw or a deterrent on the path.
Very true.
It is actually a thing that accelerates growth. It is such a wonderful thing. It is a thing to be celebrated. And it has got potential to grow and make us flower into such phenomenal spiritual heights.
I think that story will be perfect here. Another story which, according to us, is kind of misinterpreted, right?
Yes, the story, very quickly, let me recap it for our listeners. I'm sure many would have heard about it. It's a story that is told about a man who is caught in the flood, and he's waiting, he's praying to God, he's telling, Lord, I want you to come. And then the story goes that a boat comes by, and he refuses, saying that you go ahead and take somebody else because my Lord will come for me. Then a helicopter that comes to rescue him, he says, no, you go, I'm waiting for the Lord to come. And then it says that finally he perishes in the flood and he is face to face with God. And when he's face to face with God, he says, God, I called out to you, why didn't come? And God says, I sent you a helicopter and I sent you a boat. You chose to refuse them and therefore it was not possible. It is often quoted in the perspective that don't go behind God and that form because you miss...
God can come to you in any form.
Correct.
Okay, but... another way of looking at it, you know, we used to, as students, kind of retell the story to ourselves, and we used to feel that this is how it should be told. And, you know, this is the message this story actually gives. It is like we used to say that this man refuses all the help which comes to him, and finally he's in heaven and God is in front of him, and he says, God, you didn't come to save me. And God tells him that, son, you actually chose that I come to your rescue more than even your life. You know, you knew that this could, in fact, kill you. But still, you chose that, you know, I should come and rescue you. And Lord says that, because you held on to that so strongly, you are face to face with me.
If you had taken the boat and helicopter, you would be sitting at home.
Lived. Okay. And maybe, you know, you would have thought, okay, fine, I've been taken care of. But to come to face with the Lord.
I would choose to skip any boat and helicopter if I can go face to face with my
Lord. Yeah, and I think this pining is that, you know, instead of catching the boat of wisdom in Jnana, if that is the natural and spontaneous progression.
If that is our inclination.
Yes, definitely.
That's fine.
But I think, you know, reading into knowledge, which has not actually become spontaneous for us, and force ourselves into that and think that we are actually being small.
And worse than that is read it without understanding it and without experiencing the import and shower it liberally on all those who come around you, telling that don't be foolish, don't hold on to the form, it's time to move on, it's time. I mean, that I feel is, it is really not right because each person is unto himself.
And
there are as
judgmental.
Many paths.
And becoming judgmental, basically. You know? Like what Totapuri.
Exactly.
He all the while kept thinking that here is a madcap. And in the end, it so happened that he turned out to be his own guru.
Swami himself has said, of all the madnesses that afflict man, God madness is the least harmful and the most beneficial.
Definitely.
And the madness also again is like a matter of perspective, just as we saw in this helicopter story. For a God intoxicated man, the world looks like mad. For a world intoxicated person, a devotee looks mad. So what is madness actually? Everybody is mad in some way or the other. And Swami says, among all these madnesses, if you are mad after God, that is the least harmful, that is the most beneficial. So that is something wonderful.
And when I think of it, you know, the place which Swami has taken in our life, and when we actually tend to define this devotion as attachment sometimes, the fact is, whether we accept it or not, all of us have a certain amount of attachment and certain amount of this impure love. But what Swami has done is, Swami has even directed that love towards Himself. Swami has taken that place in our life where even that impure love gets directed towards Him, and it's in the process of getting purified. Just like that stuntman who stood in front of the idol and kept juggling the whole day.
And said that, O Lord, take my stunt devotion that I am having and grant me true devotion in return.
And for all that we know, the imperfections in our love for Swami itself might be the path which is going to lead us to that perfect love with Him, isn't it?
So Prem, now that we have come to the fact that yes, there's nothing wrong in missing Swami, nothing wrong in pining for that. There are those times, you know, when the missing and pining, like personally at least this is what happened to me on the January 1st, when it becomes so intense, you don't wish to eat food, you don't wish to do anything else, you just wish to be lost, and even though you are shedding tears, they are not actually sorrow, because you know sorrow pulls you down. These tears that you shed for the Lord, they uplift you, they make you feel light, they make you feel so charged, they make you feel almost like an angel of the Lord. I mean, you know, you are so suffused with Swami's love. What should we do when we come across such situations in our life? It happens. It happens so spontaneously, and it's not that it's a planned thing. But when it happens, is there something that we should do or we can do so that we can enjoy the bliss or we can benefit?
Yeah, one thing is actually a culmination of what you've spoken so far. Mm-hmm. That is to enjoy that moment, to be in that moment. And summing it up, I would say that don't let your head spoil the heart's party. Because it is actually a rejoicing moment for the heart, even though it is pain in a form. The kind of contact and the kind of closeness you feel to Swami, you will not find it in any other moment.
Correct.
So why actually bring your head and your intellect into that moment and unnecessarily spoil that, the moment of rejoicing?
And proof that that is a very special moment is because, let's be honest to ourselves, whenever we have felt this intense yearning and pain and we have shed tears saying, Swami, we miss you, we want to see you, somewhere in our heart, there is a voice that is saying that something beautiful is going to happen now. This is the way that you have pined, it is not going to go waste, something beautiful will happen. And again, innumerable have been experiences where, if not immediately, after the pining, an answer comes in the most beautiful manner in which only the Lord is capable of giving. And we know that yes, this is Swami responding. Such experiences get conferred because of this. And therefore, as you correctly, beautifully and so succinctly put it, let us not allow the head to spoil the heart's party. Because while the head enjoys logic, the heart is beyond logic. It is so fixed in the truth that it doesn't care for the logic.
And the other thing which Swami used to say is, you know, when you walk into a dark room, it gets illuminated the moment you switch on the light. Okay, and suppose you're in a dark room and you're feeling depressed. There is darkness even 1 second before the light came in. And if you gave up hope even that 1 second before, it's like you've lost. So when we yearn for Swami or when we yearn for His presence, you never know when it will come.
The problem with logic is, when we try to rationalize things, the problem with logic is that God is not logical, if we can say so. And you see this happening over and over again, where God has defied logic. And when we try to put in logic, the mistake we are doing is, the limitations that we perceive, we impress the same limitations onto the Lord, which is not true. We have no idea what are the capabilities of the Lord. After all, Swami is a master of time and space. He can do what He wants whenever He wants. So why should we try to impress our logic onto God? See, for example, if we take the scientific world, towards 1900, when that was the time, it is said that the physicists around the world said, all that is there to be done is done. There's nothing else.
True. It was believed to be that classical mechanics is all that physics is
about. You know, quantum mechanics had not been discovered. And there had been a lot of intense research that had gone in, which had proved things like an electron being a wave and not a particle, and light being waves, not particles and photons as it was thought. All this was done, and just when physics felt that it is at its culmination, at the peak, there's nothing more to be discovered, came a very strange thing. This happened when they were shining light on a metal. They saw that it was generating power, current. That's a common thing. That is the basis on which the solar cells are developed today. Light shines and you get current. But at that time, it was something amazing. And somehow, it was happening only when you shine a blue light or a violet light. It was not happening if you shine a red light.
Okay.
Now, according to the wave theory of light, it said that red light is having a greater wavelength, lesser frequency. Basically, it means it's a less energetic beam.
Okay.
And blue light is a more energetic beam. So therefore, while blue light is able to elicit electrons, red light is not able to do so. Logical. But then somebody said, okay, then shine a lot of red light. If one bucket of water cannot do something, one tank of water can do it. But while a speck of violet light was able to elicit electrons, shining how much ever red light never elicited electrons. And then physics was again at crossroads. They were not able to explain this based on the wave nature of light. And then came along Albert Einstein, who gave the beautiful photoelectric effect for which he got the Nobel Prize. And the photoelectric effect takes as an assumption that light is a particle. Just imagine, for the last 40 years, physics went about proving that light is a wave. And now Albert Einstein comes along and says, this works like this because in this experiment, light behaves like a particle.
The dual nature of light.
But that was not known at that time. So they said, are you crazy? Light is a wave and you're saying that light is a particle? He said, I'm not crazy. Don't you see it behaving like a particle? What you see is what is the truth. It's behaving like a particle in this experiment. Therefore, in your experiment, light is a wave. In this experiment, light is a particle. It seemed crazy at that time, in 1905. And that is why, you know, he got the Nobel Prize in 1930. No, later on, not 1930, but much later. Not immediately. Because at that time, it seemed so absurd. But Albert Einstein said, when experience and theory clash, I prefer to go with the experience. That's all it is. It may be illogical. It only means that we have not understood. Doesn't mean that it is not happening. And today, the theory says that light is both a wave and a particle. And why light? Even an electron, even you, even me. All of us are particles as well as waves. Seems so absurd even if we say it now. But that is the truth. That is what science has discovered. So, many times, by being logical, we are cutting away the infinite possibilities that actually exist. And that is why I feel when these intense feelings come, we should definitely not use the head, go with the heart.
Just going with that example which you gave, the photoelectric effect, you know, what has actually happening is, experience is leading to the theory being formed.
Correct.
Okay, and once the theory is formed, we are so rigid about the theory, we are not ready to accommodate any other experience. Okay, it's not just that let the experience modify the theory. The moment the theory is made from experience, you know, when they say light was a wave, it was from the experience of some experiments.
Correct.
But then, once the theory was formed, we got so stuck to that theory. And I think that's what we're doing with Swami also. Our experience has given an image of Swami.
Exactly.
And we want to just get stuck to that image. Even though there is so much experience around, which actually may be enriching our way of looking at Swami himself. And putting it in this context, yearning, it is, I think, what lies in our capabilities is just to yearn for him. And not to limit him with what logic has taught us to perceive it as.
Maybe that's the reason why we see, you know, recently I heard about a senior of mine, three years senior, he settled in Germany.
Okay.
His father is still working as a professor in our institute. He says that his three-year-old son tells that he has spoken to Swami in the physical form in Germany. I mean, you think that the child is imagining, it's fabricating. But I feel it is such a blessing that the child is experiencing. And I know it is definitely true because this is not the first child that is stating. I had a chance of speaking with some children in the primary school. One child says how he got scared to go to the toilet. And he says Swami came in white robe, held his hand and took him to the toilet. I was shocked. But the children are not shocked because they are seeing it. The child doesn't get shocked when it sees an elephant. It doesn't get shocked when it sees a cow. Doesn't get shocked when it sees Swami coming because it is what it is seeing. It's going by the experience and not by the logic. If I see Swami today, the first thing I'll think is, am I drinking too much? Am I hallucinating? Am I sleepy? Because according to me, I cannot see Swami. That is maybe the reason why kids seem to experience Swami more and more around the world. So many stories where kids are experiencing Swami more than adults, because kids have not yet been ruined with logic.
In very true, Swami has caught them in the learning stage, I think, you know. Swami has kind of accommodated himself and his logic, which is beyond logic, in their learning process itself. And, you know, just talking about the fact that Swami answering any prayer, Swami responding to any prayer, need not be based on logic or this one. I'm reminded of an amazing experience once, which was narrated in Swami's presence by one of my seniors when he was asked to speak in front of Swami. And it just shows that Swami is way beyond what we think. I mean, he is not defined by time and space, but he actually defines time and space. It seems that one alumna of the Anandapur campus, she was traveling with her mother in a train. You know, I think it was a short distance train. And in the compartment where they were sitting, they were alone. And at one particular station, a group of youngsters got in. A very jolly lot, which looked like a lot which could pass some comments on young girls around, that kind of a thing. The moment they got in, the mother got a bit concerned. And she felt that if the situation would become a little ugly, and she wouldn't be able to handle it. So she started praying to Swami, that Swami, you should do something. It's your daughter, you have to take care of her. You know, if these boys start commenting, I don't know what to do and all that. So just at that time, the girl excused herself and she said, I'll just go to the
washroom.
The washroom and come. So she went, and this mother was praying that, okay, at least for 3 minutes, this girl will be away from the presence of all these youngsters. So she'll be safe. So the mother was waiting. It was 15 minutes, the girl didn't come back.
Okay. You know,
half an hour, and the girl still hasn't come back. And almost an hour and a half passed, and the station where they are supposed to get down is almost there, and this girl has still not come. And just before they reach the station, which is well after 1.5 hours, this girl just comes out of the bathroom. She casually comes and she sits down. And the mother is, in a sense, she's happy that, you know, she could be away from all these...
But hiding in the toilet for so long.
Okay. And the mother asked her, what were you doing in the washroom for 1.5 hours? And the girl said, what 1.5 hours? He said, you were in the bathroom for 1.5 hours. And she said, no, I just went and I just came back. And for that girl, it was just those 2 or 3 minutes. But for the rest of these people in the compartment, she was in the bathroom for 1.5 hours.
Wow.
I mean, can you
compression.
Yeah, and can you imagine how Swami has played with time and space? Because for this girl, she's just been there for 3 minutes.
Wow. And let's say, you know, even as you started narrating this, example of how logic can be woefully inadequate. I just started imagining, because previously I had heard an experience of how a similar situation arose for another girl from the Anandapur campus. I don't know if she was from the Anandapur campus, but she didn't even have her mother traveling along with her. And there was an empty seat by her side. And then a drunken man got onto the train. And she got worried. Now, if he comes and sits, what is going to happen? But he came till the spot where she was there, but did not sit next to her. All the while, just stood. In fact, when one of the persons also suggested, why don't you just sit there? Just in an amount of, you know, irritation. That drunken man turned back with irritation and said, are you mad? Don't you see that person already sitting there? And, you know, that drunken man was seeing Swami sitting there. You know, such things Swami is capable of. I mean, how blessed is the drunken man that he could see Swami, what that girl praying for is not able to see.
This is no suggestion for anybody to start taking to the habit.
No. But even as you started narrating that story, I this experience of that girl, I thought maybe you're narrating this. And I was waiting for this climax. And I was thinking, what is this? This girl has gone to the bathroom, into the washroom, because this was not part of that story. So I got lost somewhere in between. But then see, that is what logic does. It limits you. Now, based on a previous experience, I am limiting the future. But there is no limitation. Anything is possible.
Any number of possibilities are present in it. I mean, this may be a little off the discussion. I'm just reminded of what Anil Kumar sir, during one of his speeches, later in experience, a man came to him and he came with an invitation for his daughter's wedding. And he requested Anil Kumar sir to get it blessed by Swami and tell Swami that this person's daughter is getting married. Mm. And Anil Kumar sir, knowing Swami, he said, I mean, that's the last thing anybody who knows Swami will do, because Swami never encourages that. And Anil Kumar sir very nicely told him that, you sit in darshan, why do you want to think that Swami will not bless you?
Mm.
If Swami wants to bless you, definitely Swami will bless you. I mean, there is nothing like so-and-so is closer or so-and-so is not close. You pray sincerely to Swami, Swami will definitely bless you. And he was happy that he just got away from the situation.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, later that day, this person came and had this to share, how Swami blessed him.
Mm-hmm.
And it so happened that that day when he wanted to take blessings from Swami, he got the last token.
Okay.
So he was about 15-20 lines away from where Swami was coming. And Swami was coming in a car. Mm-hmm. These days that Swami had already started coming in the car. So there was no way he could actually get to give this invitation for his daughter's wedding to Swami directly, or get any form of blessing. And he had this bowl of what you call akshatas, right? The raw rice mixed with turmeric. So he had that in one bowl, and the invitation. So even as Swami was passing by in the car, he just held up that bowl of akshatas.
Okay.
Okay, and held up this invitation. And he just prayed to Swami, Swami, my daughter's wedding, please bless.
Hmm.
And Swami passed by. And later when he looked into that bowl of akshatas, there was the Mangal Sutra.
Oh, the necklace that is given to the bride.
The bride.
Wow,
it Imagine it had materialized in the bowl he was holding in his hand.
Wow.
That is why I'm saying there is limitless
possibilities
the way Swami can respond to our prayer.
So, when we feel this pining for Swami, when we feel that we are missing him, okay, so that is spontaneous. We have agreed, we cannot plan it. But when it happens, what are the things we should do? Among them, first thing is what we should not do is don't allow logic to set in. Just go with the flow and go with the heart. Right?
Exactly. Definitely. The moment you understand that this is such an important moment, you will not let it pass.
Correct.
You will want to cherish it. You will want to treasure it.
Hmm. Before we go into that, Prem, maybe we can take a short break. And yes, dear listeners, so involved have we been in our satsang that you may think that we have forgotten. No, we would love all of you to participate in the satsang. Do write to us at listener@radiosai.org with your thoughts, your feelings. We are now discussing on what all we should do and we should not do when we get this kind of intense pining and longing and missing Swami. More of that after this short break, where we will listen to another bhajan, seeking and pining for Swami's darshan. This is taken from the album by Sai Blossoms named Bhavanjali.
Yeah, the volume one of Bhavanjali.
Bhavanjali.
दर्शन दो प्रभु साई नाथा
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 दर्श दिखाओ साई नाथा दर्श दिखाओ साई नाथा
दर्श दिखाओ साई नाथा
दर्शन दो प्रभु साई नाथा
दर्शन दो प्रभु साई नाथा
अर्ज सुनो मेरे श्याम गोपाल अर्ज सुनो मेरे श्याम गोपाल
अर्ज सुनो मेरे
श्याम गोपाल श्याम गोपाल साईं गोपाल
श्याम
मुझे सुनो मेरे साई गोपाला वृंदावन के नंदलाला दर्शन दो प्रभु साई नाथा
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 दर्श दिखाओ साई नाथा
दर्श दिखाओ
दर्शन दो प्रभु साई नाथा
दर्शन दो प्रभु साई नाथा
अर्ज सुनो मेरे श्याम गोपाल दर्शन दो प्रभु साई नाथा.
Wow, that was a beautiful bhajan prem. And maybe that's one more thing we can do, right? When we are feeling such intense missing that we are missing Swami, listen to a bhajan or watch a video of Swami.
Definitely anything which kind of extends that feeling for as long as possible.
Listen to Radio Sai.
Yeah, why not? Definitely, because I happen to tell somebody, listen to Radio Sai, you don't have to listen to us.
Correct.
We have something called a disco stream, we have something called a bhajan stream, which these are all easiest ways of being in touch with Swami.
Because let's face it, Prem, even when Swami was physically here in Prashanthi Nilayam, suppose I'm sitting in London or Texas or why so far, even somewhere in Bangalore or Bombay, in India also, if I miss Swami intensely, and this used to happen when Swami is physically there also, what would I do? Suppose I am in Mumbai and I am missing Swami intensely. It is not that I would just leave everything, catch a flight and come to Bangalore and then go to Prashanthi Nilayam and have darshan or Vrindavan where Swami was. It would not be that way. I would just tell myself that no, this is good. Let me kindle this fire of longing in me. And whenever I meet Swami, whenever that be, whenever He wills, I will meet Him. And when I meet Him, it will be there somewhere within that He will reward me for this pining.
Mm-hmm.
The beautiful thing about pining is even as we pine, we know in our heart that this pining will be rewarded. And so sitting in Mumbai, I would listen to Swami's bhajans or read His discourses or see some video and know that no problem. Whenever Swami wills, I will see Him and I will be rewarded. Why don't we carry on with the same now? Why do we feel things have changed now? Why don't we feel that now when I'm missing Him so much, let me read about Swami, let me see Swami, let me hear about Swami, let me listen to bhajans. And whenever is the correct time, Swami will call me and I will see Him. Why don't we just do that? That's a nice thing to do, right?
Exactly. And I think progressively what would happen is, you know, I mean, as you said, when we were elsewhere and Swami was here, and when you knew that the pining which we had would reflect in Swami rewarding us with something, I think slowly we will realize that the reward lies in pining itself. The moment spent in pining itself is the greatest reward. Because, you know, many times I've felt that when sitting as a student, and, you know, VIPs come, politicians come, and the code of conduct demanded that Swami gives them an audience. Mm. So Swami always used to say that even a king in his sabha, he had to seat people according to their status.
Mm.
It was not a spiritually wrong thing to do.
It's not discrimination.
Yeah, it was Sangha Niti, basically. It is like doing what the moral code of the society demands.
Yeah, if you say that way, it's like telling it's wrong that you're keeping head at a top position and putting foot on the floor. I mean, you won't put your head on the floor, right? Because it's like that the organ serves.
Or asking somebody, why do you apply powder only to your face and why not to the sole of your feet? And you know, so what I'm trying to say is, when those moments used to happen and somebody used to come and walk in and have an interview, I used to feel that, you know, Swami is sitting here and pining for a word of yours or to be in your presence. Maybe I'm gaining more than what that fellow actually gets by being in your presence in the interview room, because he doesn't value it. He doesn't value my pining as much as the presence of Swami, actually.
Hmm. You know, that reminds me of Chinna Katha. I think we had discussed this when we did a satsang on Chinna Kathas alone.
Mm-hmm.
But this Chinna Katha beautifully shows the value of pining. Swami says there was a disciple who wanted a mantra from his guru.
Mm-hmm.
A mantra that would redeem him.
Okay, yeah, that one, fine.
Uh-huh.
We had discussed it in...
Correct. So, yeah, so he asks guru to give a mantra. The guru writes the mantra on the floor, and by the time the disciple comes from work, he has already left his body. And the writing has been erased, and the disciple feels that I have served my guru for 15 years for this mantra and I couldn't get it. What has actually happened is a dancer girl has written down this mantra on a palm leaf and kept it with her. And when she finds out how much he is longing for it, she says, you serve me then. When I feel it fine, I'll give it to you. He serves her for 15 years and she's a dancer, and when she's dancing in front of the king, she has kept that palm leaf, Swami says, in her earring. And you know, Swami used to, when he is narrating the story, he builds on and on and on, and the story goes on for about 15 minutes.
Just to show how desperate that aspirant was.
Correct. So you really want to know, what is this mantra for which the aspirant is seeking so much? And Swami says, and then the king threw for the dancer a pair of diamond earrings. And seeing the diamond earrings, the dancer, she just removed off the palm leaf earring, you know, on which the mantra was there, mm-hmm. and she just throws it to the ground. The one mantra for which one person has pined for 30 years, she just throws it down without any attachment, because the diamond earrings are coming. Then all the people who are listening are waiting for Swami to conclude and say, then the mantra was this, and Swami concludes the story by saying, he opened, saw the mantra, and he got liberated in an instant. And then Swami continues to say, it doesn't matter what that mantra was. The pining was such that any mantra there, any word there, any letter there would have redeemed that man. And that message is, you know, even beautifully portrayed in that lovely cartoon movie, Kung Fu Panda. You know, Kung Fu Panda is struggling for the dragon scroll. And when he opens the scroll, there is nothing. The secret to life is nothing but that pining and longing and wanting. That is what gives deservedness and gives the bounty.
Very true, Arvind. You know, the other day, we were just having a small discussion within ourselves. We were asking many times, if you read a discourse of Swami, see, Swami is the master of everything. He can actually give you the perfect understanding through his words. But it doesn't happen always. If that is the case, sitting through one discourse should have clarified all our doubts.
Correct, because every discourse is complete.
Yeah, every discourse is complete. And, you know, if you go and ask Swami, Swami, what is the secret of creation? Swami would say, you and I are God.
You and I are one, yeah.
And Swami has told it innumerable number of times. But why is that not giving us the ultimate understanding? Because I think it lies in seeking.
Yeah.
The crux of the matter lies in the questions. All the answers are lying. The Satyasai Speaks is filled with answers. But the thing is, unless we ask those questions in right earnest, and then the answer comes to us, it actually makes no difference to our progress.
There's nothing like the right answer,
Answer. Exactly. And you know, this is actually explained in, I think it comes in the life of one of the Sufi saints. If I'm not wrong, I just hope my memory serves me right. And it seems he's sitting and he's giving a discourse, and all his disciples are sitting around him. And one man comes in the middle of the discourse. Okay, and he sits in the back. at the end of the discourse, this master says that if any of you have any questions to ask, you can ask me.
Mm.
So this man who came in between, he gets up and he asks one question, which apparently looks like everybody in the audience knew the answer.
Mm.
In an intellectual level, they knew the answer for that question, but he asks the question, and the master also gives a reply, which none of these people can actually appreciate or, you know, understand the import of. It just looked like a simple question and answer. And this man who asked that question, after the answer is given to him, just looks up, pauses for a few seconds, without saying anything, just gets up and walks.
Mm.
And the master says he's through.
Wow.
Master says, yeah, he's done, he's liberated.
Mm.
And everybody around is surprised. Because actually it didn't...
look so grand
and
event.
The key to the liberation did not lie in either the question or the answer. It was in that seeking. It was in that earnestness. And it was in that yearning.
It also is surprising and shocking because we feel enlightenment or moksha or liberation is a grandiose event, you know. The sky will open up and a light will come and you will levitate. All this is what we imagine because that is how we metaphorically indicate the grandeur of that event. But it can happen through as simple thing as you pour a mug of water while having bath, as you put a morsel of food into your mouth. As long as the pining is there, you never know which is the 100th blow that is actually breaking the rock. It is wrong to think that it is the 100th blow that actually broke the rock. And wrong to criticize and feel that the 99 blows before were useless and of no avail. The pining is like those blows which keep hitting, 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 and finally suddenly through a, you never know when it will happen, the switch will be put on.
Like somebody was telling the other day, the problem with all of us is we keep coming to conclusions every now and then. Because conclusions is supposed to be
come in the end,
but we keep concluding every now and then. You know, because based on, as you were talking about the photoelectric effect, the moment one experience is there, we conclude.
Correct.
Another experience comes, if you are broad-hearted enough to accept it, then we take that experience and again conclude. And all the while we are concluding with the experiences we have. And I think the point where we realize that let us just let all the experience flow in and let's conclude when actually the concluding moment comes.
You were saying about sitting outside and pining for Swami as he gave interviews to the VIPs or different people who came. You know, about how pining is actually more important than getting. If we see the life of, say, historically, if we see many saints and sages in India, if we see Saint Ramadas, he sought Rama, he wanted Rama always. So much so that it is said that he was a tasildar and he got a temple for Lord Rama built from public money.
Which still is there.
Bhadrachalam, very close by to Puttaparthi. Not very close, but quite close.
In the same state.
He has got this temple built for Lord Rama and people, you know, go and tell the Tanisha, who was a Muslim ruler. They tell him that, see, he is using public funds to build Hindu temples. They incite the Tanisha against. And he orders that Ramadas be imprisoned or pay up the money. Now, how can he pay up the money? It's already been used to construct the temple. The story goes that Lord Rama and his brother Lakshmana go to the Tanisha and repay the money on behalf of Ramadas. Now look at this thing, Prem. Ramadas is the one who has been pining to have a glimpse of Lord Rama. And here Tanisha gets darshan for free. But the difference is, though the Tanisha has seen Lord Rama, nothing happens to him. But towards the end of his life, Ramadas gets a glimpse of Rama and that's it. Like a bulb exploding under 1000 watts, under a heavy current. Like that his body is unable to bear the joy that comes from that experience. And what made him worthy to receive that experience was that pining. Without pining, how many other times you see Rama, nothing happens. We've heard of stories or experience of people who have gone into raptures by touching the tip of Swami's toe. And I felt that I have touched Swami's feet 1000 times and I have not had quarter of the rapture that they're having. It's not about the act. It's about the intensity and longing and pining.
And the same thing, story of Shabari from Ramayana.
Mm-hmm.
She spends all her youthful days and all her life waiting for that moment when Lord Rama will come. And that one session where she actually has to give hospitality to Lord Rama is enough.
Enough to
redeem her.
And she's been doing that for years and years on the end. You know, Prem, I'm reminded of, again, another episode from the life of another great saint. Devotee, singer, composer, everything, you know. Mirabai.
true.
Mirabai was mad after Krishna. And she came in an era thousands of years after Lord Krishna existed on the earth. I mean, so seeing by the modern day times, the way, you know, explanations are given, somebody should have told Meera, Meera, it's wrong, you're pining for Krishna.
It's
Krishna
time to move on.
It's time to move on. Come on, evolve, you're one with Krishna and all that. She actually became one with Krishna through her love and pining for Krishna. I remember in Trai Vrindavan, we were seated and there were these students who were singing Meera bhajans.
Okay.
And Swami was hearing the Meera bhajans. And Swami got so lost, it was like, you know, reciprocating. Like how Meera would sing about Krishna and get lost. She would get transported to the days of the Gopikas dancing with Krishna. It was as if listening to the song of Meera, Swami was transported to Meera and he was with Mirabai. It was like that. And then came a beautiful song, you know, Darshana Dijo Aao. It is said that this was the song that Meera sang out finally, because she said, I have done everything, I have gone everywhere, but Krishna, I am not able to see you, I want to see you, I want to see you. And this song was so beautiful, Swami was moved into tears. And then Swami went on to explain, he said, a line comes there, you know, that Meera is your servant for lifetimes together, not only this one life. And Swami said that that Mirabai, for her, darshan of the Lord was so necessary, it was more vital than air for her. And so she went to the threshold of the temple of Krishna and started banging her forehead. And Swami showed that action, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He showed it. He said that like this she moved her head and she banged it, her head started, forehead started bleeding. She said, Krishna, I don't want my body, I don't want my life, I don't want anything, I just want. And in that moment Krishna comes. Because once that pining and reaches that intensity, miracles of any kind happen in an instant, spontaneously, just like you switch on a light bulb. And Swami said that that is what happened. And, you know, Meera saw Lord Krishna. Now this, I got a chance to witness, if I can say, Swami's emotion, Swami's passion and Swami's intensity when he was speaking about the devotee's intensity. It felt so wonderful, because what the devotee is showing is what the Lord is also showing. More than 1,000 years after Mirabai. And then that same year, you know, the students from the school planned to put up a drama on Mirabai's life, mm-hmm, in Swami's presence in Kulwant Hall.
Yeah, correct.
In 2006 or 2007, I don't remember exactly. Okay. During the January time. And since I was a senior student involved in dramatics, I was called to help them in putting the drama, the dialogues and all, okay, in order. I noticed that in the whole script, this song which Swami had described about in Trai Vrindavan, you know, telling that this was the song with which Meera got Krishna, it was missing. So it was lucky that I had got this chance to be in Trai there, and therefore I said, you know, Swami was very this about this song, so we should include this song. Now this song had been sung in Trai Vrindavan by a male singer, a student. Okay. And now here the confusion was, now if Mirabai is going to sing, who will sing this song? We need to get a female singer, because it was a boy acting as Mirabai. You can put costumes and make a boy look like a girl. Now how do you disguise a voice? We have to find a female voice. But you know, somehow everybody, the elders, everyone felt that Swami is Bhavapriya. He loves the feeling. So on the final day, Mirabai sang in a masculine voice. In the sense, the person who gave the voice was the same boy who had sung in Trai Vrindavan months earlier.
Okay.
And came the scene, and my God, the whole hall was charged. You know, when this song came and Meera is pining, Meera is crying and banging her head on the threshold, and Swami broke down on stage. I had told you, Swami narrated that at this point Krishna appeared.
Right.
And that point in the song came. This was the time for Krishna to appear. And even before Krishna could appear, you know, Swami called Mirabai.
Mm-hmm.
He said, Mirabai. He called her, I mean him. And on the spot, instantly materialized a chain, put it around his neck and made him take Padanamskar. You know, it was a drama in real life. This was what happened centuries ago, and just reliving the pangs of separation of another devotee, just reliving that in itself, made this boy win the heart of Swami, get a Pada Namaskar, get a chain, and filled his heart with love for Swami. That is the magic, that is the power of pining and longing and intensity.
Definitely. Beautiful. I mean, many times, you know, when Swami would sit and ask for kirtanas composed by Tyagaraja, songs composed by Meera, it often used to occur, you know, what kind of feeling would have gone behind these songs that after so many hundreds of years, the Lord comes in a human form and still is relishing those songs. What an impact it has made on the Lord. And I remember when we were students in Vrindavan, the very famous singer, Begum Parveena Sultana, she was giving a concert. She was sitting on the stage. Swami was sitting down and we were sitting around Swami. And at one point, Swami stopped her and said, can you sing that Meera Bhajan? Mere to Giridhar Gopal. And she, you know, very humbly said, Swami, I don't know that song. I'm sure she would have known it, but they were so devoted to Swami, they wouldn't present anything to Swami unless
they
it was perfect. So she said that, Swami, I don't know. And Swami was so upset. He said, what? You don't know this song? Meera song, you don't know. And she's another great devotee. The very next time when she had the opportunity to sing in front of Swami, she started with the song. She said, Swami, ask for the song. I'm offering the song to Swami. And the way Swami enjoyed that song. And coming back to that, you know, there might be many other great compositions. There might be many other literally perfect compositions and musically beautiful compositions. But I think it was that emotion which these devotees infused into that through their pining and through their pain, that so many hundreds of centuries later, not only Swami is responding to that, it kind of kindles that same yearning and pain in our own hearts, isn't it?
Very true, Prem. And though my heart longs to go on, my head is saying that in spite of all the logic that you say that you should not follow, this is something that we can continue on. Briefly recapping what we discussed so far is that there is nothing wrong. There's nothing weak or nothing wrong in pining and missing Swami. And whenever we pine and miss Swami, there's an intense surge of energy and vitality that comes. It comes out as tears, it comes out as so many things.
What I feel is Swami is definitely within us. But I think these moments of pining and yearning takes us closer to the Swami within us.
And make the Swami within us, if needed, even manifest outside so that we can see Him even with our physical eyes.
Absolutely.
So some of the things that we discussed today that we can do, one thing is do not allow logic to creep in. And second thing is two things like reading Swami's books or listening to His songs.
Which will sustain that emotion.
Correct. If you have written a personal diary about our experiences with Him, go read that. Do whatever, but be lost in that Swami principle, because what we are receiving in those moments is something tremendous. We are so receptive that it benefits us so much. There has been a rich history of so many saints and sages who have achieved the Lord in such moments of receptivity.
Because dear listeners, we really hope that, I mean, we know that this feeling of pining and yearning is universal among Swami's devotees. We know that each one of you there would have found your own way of dealing with it. Not in the sense of, you know, suppressing it. Dealing with it is not what we mean in that sense. You would have found your own way of fostering this feeling and pain. And we would love to know that what are your ways of doing it. And we would love to share
your experiences.
And your joy of experiencing the sweetness of that pain. We would love to share it with all our listeners. And we would like to make this satsang truly a satsang of all our hearts.
And Prem, before we conclude, so much, you know, we spoke about that song which Swami enjoyed, Meera Bhai's song. Maybe we should conclude with that song, offering our most humble and loving and everything gratitude to Swami for giving us this chance to have known Him, to have stayed with Him, to have lived with Him, to have enjoyed His presence, and to have enjoyed His omnipresence. We conclude this satsang, part one of this satsang, with this Meera Bhai song about she pining to see the Lord.
A very, very beautiful song, dear listeners. We are leaving you with this song. Thank you, Sai Ram, and happy listening.
Krishna, 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 Krishna. Krishna. Darshan di chowa, pyare darshan di chowa. Darshan di chowa, pyare darshan di chowa. Tum bin rayo na jaye pyare, tum bin rayo na jaye pyare, darshan di chowa, darshan di chowa. Jal bin kamal, chanda bin rajani. Jal bin kamal, chanda bin rajani. Aise tum dekha bin sajani. Aise tum dekha bin sajani. Akul vyakula फिर रैन दिना अकुल व्याकुल फिर रैन दिना बिरह कले जोखा बिरह कले जोखा प्यारे दर्शन दी जोआ प्यारे दर्शन दी दिवस न भूख नींद नहीं रहना दिवस न भूख नींद नहीं रहना मुख सूख थतना वे बैना मुख सूख थतना वे बैना कहा कहूँ कुछ कहतना वे कहा कहूँ कुछ कहतना वे मिलकर तपत बुझा मिलकर तपत बुझा प्यारे दर्शन दी जोआ प्यारे दर्शन दी जोआ क्यों तरसा वो अंतर्यामी मपधाधा धनी सारे धानी पा पधनी सारे गा रे सनी रे सनी द सनी द बनी द प द म प ग म रे ग स रे ग म प ध नि सा क्यों तरसा वो अंतर्यामी आई मिलो कृपा कर स्वामी मेरा दासी जन्म जन्म की मेरा दासी जन्म जन्म की परी तुम्हारे पार परी तुम्हारे पार प्यार
हरे दर्शन दीजो आ प्यारे दर्शन दीजो आ तुम बिन रहो ना जाए प्यारे तुम बिन रहो ना जाए प्यारे दर्शन दीजो आ दर्शन दीजो आ दर्शन दीजो आ दर्शन दीजो आ।